Hello. Well, on this Easter Monday, welcome to a conversation about religion and the modern world, unlike any other you'll hear, I hope. From Lambeth Palace, home of the Archbishops of Canterbury since 1197, I'm joined by the present incumbent, Dr. Rowan Williams, to talk about the plight of oppressed Christians around the world and the condition of his church. By the hugely successful novelist and atheist, Philip Pullman, whose latest book is called The Good Man Jesus and The Scoundrel Christ, and was, he says, partly inspired by the Archbishop. But our discussion doesn't stop there. With me, too, is another brave fellow, the comedian and writer David Baddiel, whose new film, The Infidel, tells the story of a British Muslim man who discovers, shock horror, that he's really Jewish. And Mona Siddiqui, professor of Islamic studies, who has the unenviable job of trying to persuade the business world to take religion and religious values more seriously in the Towers of Mammon. And the sirens you can hear are not the Metropolitan Police rushing to stop our conversation before it's got going. We are right beside a hospital. So, nothing bland today. Let's start with the Archbishop of Canterbury himself. Archbishop, at Easter, you look around the world, and, of course, in the West, Christianity may be in trouble because of materialism and the post-Enlightenment culture and all sorts of things we can talk about. But in other parts of the world, it's much more basic than that.
Indeed, the problems are much more serious. And I think we lose sight in this country very often of just how vulnerable some of the Christian communities around the world are. It's partly the knock-on effect, of course, of the global politics of the last decade or so. Christian minorities that have in Muslim environments been part of the furniture for many, many centuries are suddenly seen, suddenly cast as Western outposts. And that makes them particularly vulnerable. And you see that in Iraq at the moment, in Mosul, you see it in Nigeria. And it's a major issue.
And what about some of those really old Christian communities in places like Syria and Lebanon, who've been there really since Christianity has got going?
One of my Arab Christian friends was once asked by a not terribly well-informed American when his family became Christian, and he said, well, about 2,000 years ago. And that's something which, again, we lose sight of. We think, oh, Middle East, Muslims and Jews, that's all there is to say. And it's been a much more complex tapestry for a long time. With, of course, as I was hearing in the Middle East just a few weeks ago, villages where, until quite recently, Christians and Muslims celebrated each other's festivals.
Mm. It's astonishing. And I suppose the other particularly dangerous and difficult areas at the moment would be in Africa. I'm thinking of Nigeria, northern Nigeria, where there's a lot of trouble, and Zimbabwe.
Northern Nigeria is a complicated picture. It's certainly not just a Christian-Muslim standoff between local faith groups. It's partly encouraged by militants from outside. It's also got its tribal elements, but it's certainly been a very bloody picture in recent weeks. Zimbabwe is different again, and there we've had the extraordinary picture of some of our own Anglican congregations being locked out of their churches in recent months because of troubles with the government. The former bishop in Harare was a Mugabe supporter. He was deposed, I think, quite rightly, to most people's delight, and since then has been waging a minor war against his successor with a lot of help from the security forces. So at Easter, you know, thinking of all those stories about locked doors because people are afraid of persecution, and Jesus coming through locked doors and the resurrection appearances, suddenly that's not so abstract in Zimbabwe.
Not at all, not at all. And of course, this is a time when Christians focus on the spiritual heart of their faith. The Anglican Communion, however, has had a very, very hard year or two on the institutional side. I mean, one of the things I hope we'll talk about is the tension between the kernel of belief and the structures placed around them.
Absolutely. I think at the institutional level, it's a constant circle-squaring exercise. And I know there's one of Philip's great themes. Is it worth putting the energy one does into institutional life in this sort of framework? At grassroots level, and the parishes I visit on Sundays, the visits I was making recently to some community projects in Lincolnshire, you think, well, an amazing number of people are getting on with it, and they're not actually reading the headlines very much. But headlines do matter, and they do preoccupy a lot of people in the public eye. So, no, not straightforward.
So do you find, in terms of your job, the politics and the institutional, the bureaucratic aspects of the job, the toughest parts?
On the whole, yes, to be honest. It's looking for short-term solutions for what are really long-term problems. It's often looking for structural solutions to what are really personal or relational problems. You've got to do the work on that level, but it's deeply frustrating, and it very seldom feels as if it's got much to do with the core of things.
And what about the other great Christian church in this country, the Catholic Church? You've had problems, but not on the scale they have at the moment, it has to be said, with the paedophile priest issue and so on.
It's been, I think, in Ireland especially, a colossal corporate trauma, hasn't it? Mm. And I was speaking to an Irish friend recently who was saying that it's quite difficult in some parts of Ireland to go down the street wearing a clerical collar now. And an institution so deeply bound in to the life of the society, suddenly losing all credibility. And that's not just a problem for the church, it is a problem for everybody in Ireland. Mm. Mm.
But it also seems to me to be absolutely the core of this problem about being an institution and having ethical and moral beliefs, because every institution wants to protect itself as an institution. And it seems some of, as it were, the reluctance to be open about it is simply, you don't wash your dirty linen in public, the institution mustn't be damaged.
I think it's a lesson we've all had to learn the hard way, really, because I guess that for an awful lot of Christian institutions until fairly recently, the default setting would be, got to try and hang on to the institution's credibility. And, well, we've learned that that is damaging, it's wrong, it's dishonest, and it requires that very hard recognition, which ought to be natural for the Christian church, based as it is on repentance and honesty. Mm. We've had to learn, well, honesty and truthfulness are the only way in which we can survive in any way as an institution.
Yes, and with the Pope due to make a major visit to this country before long, any reflections on relationships between your church and his? Because there was that sort of moment which certainly felt almost like a kind of papal coup a little while ago, when he was saying anyone Anglican who doesn't like them will make special arrangements for them to come and join us.
I don't think it was really a coup. I think all the language of tanks on the lawn was wheeled out very melodramatically. It didn't feel quite like that. It felt a bit more like different bits of the Vatican not quite knowing what other bits were doing. More institutional problems, and somebody's bright idea suddenly emerging into the light a bit prematurely. I don't think it's going to be a big deal for the Church of England, I must say. I think there will be a few people who take advantage of it, and they'll take advantage of it because they believe they ought to be in communion with the Bishop of Rome. Mm. And I can only say, fine, God bless them. I don't at the moment. And so, we proceed on that basis, and we talk with, I hope, a level of mutual respect on that basis.
Yes, but a sort of a friendly standing to one side relationship during that papal visit, you think?
The Pope will be coming here to Lambeth Palace. We'll have the bishops together to meet him. I'm concerned that he has a chance to say what he wants to say in and to British society, that we welcome him as a valued partner, and that's about it.
Philip Pullman, you're a well-known atheist as well as a hugely successful author. I don't know if it's a friendship you have with the Archbishop, but you certainly know each other rather well, and your new book was partly influenced by him, I think.
Well, certainly sparked off by a conversation that we had, 7 years ago, 6 or 7 years ago? Something like that, on the stage of the National Theatre. And I enjoyed that conversation very much, but the Archbishop sprung a question on me, which I wasn't quite prepared for. He pointed out that although I deal with religion and his dark materials, I don't mention Jesus, and he wondered why that was. And it occurred to me that was true. Yes, of course, but I don't. And I ought to do that. So I said, well, I'll try and touch on that subject in another book.
And this is the book which reads rather like a kind of lost part of the Gospels almost, doesn't it? It's in terms of its prose style.
Well, I don't
see the Archbishop wincing at that.
No, I don't think that's quite right, because the Gospels are a most extraordinary kind of narrative. They're not like any other kind of narrative that I know. They're not like novels. They're not like novels because they're not interested in the things that novels are interested in. Novels are very good at dealing with people's personal emotions and the emotional relationships between people and how people operate and come together and fight and entangle and fall in love and so on in a society. That's not what the Gospels are interested in. Also, you have no idea what the characters look like, which is a very
Yes. But there is something, if I can put it this way, spare almost about the prose you've decided to use.
Well, I decided to do without landscapes and without weather. And landscapes and weather are both big weapons in the novelist's arsenal because you can do such a lot with them. But I thought I'd try and do it without them, try and be as spare as possible.
So this is, in a way, a reply to the Archbishop's original question.
Well, yes, I had to think about Jesus, and I have been thinking about Jesus for a long time, and reading the Gospels and the Epistles, indeed, and the work of some Jesus scholars, not many, because I didn't want to become too distracted by different possibilities. I found it an extraordinarily interesting subject, absolutely fascinating subject. And I tried to tell the story in a way that made sense to me, which was to look at the two constituents of the name Jesus Christ, which is really a name and a title, and to separate them up and to dramatize the difference by making two characters out of them. When it comes to the title of my book, I thought I should set out the stool and put my cards on the table from the beginning. That's the way I see the dichotomy. Jesus was a good man who said good things and told wonderful stories and was betrayed and executed. And the Christ element is the element of the church that comes in and, as it were, takes over the story and changes it and makes it into something else.
In many ways, Philip Pullman is novelising or fictionalising what we started off talking about, isn't he, Archbishop? The institution and the essence.
I think one of the main themes to come out of Philip's book is that that very strong sense that the price you pay for transmitting a spiritual vision in institutional terms can be very high. And the question sometimes is not so much about the nature of the vision as about the price you want to pay for sustaining it. I think the argument of the book, if I read it rightly, is
absolutely
Christianity has paid too high a price. I obviously think not, but...
Well, that's where we disagree. But that is, you're exactly right. That's what I'm saying.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. Mona Siddiqui, one of the, of course, huge differences between Christianity and Islam is that Islam did not create the kind of large bureaucratic structure that Christianity has employed really since the earliest days.
But Sunni Islam doesn't. Shi Islam does. Shi Islam does have the concept of the imams who are successors and would trace their lineage right back to the Prophet. A lot of contemporary Iranians may disagree with the actual literal truth of that, but the imamate is a clerical structure in Shi Islam, but not in Sunni Islam, no.
So is it possible to have an effective, transmitted religious life that doesn't have large institutional structures around it?
I think it's quite hard to imagine, because you look at movements which try quite systematically to avoid that, and 50 years down the line, you see mysteriously that the surface is beginning to harden. You're beginning to get institutional transmission. Look at even the history of the Society of Friends, which I suppose in the Christian spectrum is the most anti-institutional of all. It still swings inexorably towards that. Because I suppose you need some way of recognizing from generation to generation that you're talking about the same vision. What matters is not to me so much whether you have the institution or not, as whether the institution has in it enough things to rein you in, to draw you back to where you started, and give you a real ground for saying, wait a minute, that's not it.
David Baddiel.
It may be the case that the urge to institutionalise is with all parts of human endeavour, because even atheists have like the Humanist Association, and it seems...
Schisms.
There are atheist schisms, there certainly are. And people defining themselves as agnostic or atheist or whatever, it might seem like the most individual choice, but there is a kind of need to commune in whatever belief you have.
There is a difference, though, between institutionalised expressions of religion, which give context to religious expression and give context to people and a reference point, and then how sacred the people who are the leaders within that structure become. And I think we need to differentiate between that.
Mm. Philip Pullman.
The process seems to me always that there's a great original visionary who says, a time is coming soon when heaven will be fulfilled and earth will be full of plenty and delight and wonder and so on, and then it doesn't happen. And it doesn't happen, and it goes on not happening. And eventually the people who want to preserve this vision have to set up institutions to validate their own positions.
But there also have to be rules, don't there? Because all religions have a vision of the good life and what is a good way of living, and that requires rules,
That's a vision that has a shape. You know, you can't say anything counts as a good life. But the temptation then is to to push that more and more and more towards codes where you can tick boxes and sort of present your score at the end. And I think that is one of the things that the Gospels really do try to undermine. And actually, not just the Gospels. I think it's a great fallacy to say that there's a big difference between Jewish and Christian scripture on this. Something of the same is going on in a lot of what we call the Old Testament as well.
Bureaucracy always overcomes vision. It's a tragedy. And it always will be a tragedy.
But if you've got stories which have a strong moral, ethical content, and people are forced to keep going back and reading the stories again and reinterpreting the stories, isn't that part of the answer to the constant fossilization or hardening caused by the structure?
Yes, bureaucracy will always be undermined by stories, but in the end, bureaucracy will always win. That's why I think it's a tragedy.
Dr. Williams?
In that sense, you're saying a tragedy with no possible way out. The bureaucracy always wins. I think I'd say the stories are stronger than that. I hate saying that to a novelist, but I think stories are very, very tough.
Part of the point of Philip's book is that the bureaucracy is set up, as it were, to inject another element into the original story, i.e. to preserve what Philip talks about as a greater truth that is nothing to do with history, i.e. to take what might be a story of a man who just said some good things and make it into a much, much greater, much more powerful thing. And that's what the bureaucracy is set up to do.
That seems to me a bit more intentional than the way a lot of these things work. What I see as I read the New Testament is a central event, the life of Jesus, the words of Jesus, the death of Jesus, and for me also the resurrection of Jesus, causing such a kind of explosion of ideas and puzzles that the language that already exists can't cope with, that you have a very complicated period during which the language is settling down in new ways, and you then begin to see the emergence of what we're calling a bureaucracy, an institutional structure to hold it all. But it's not quite as though someone comes along and says, this is a really good idea here, I'll market it for you.
Coming into Lambeth Palace, I was just struck by these grand portraits of guys and extraordinary, and they're all authority figures. We now live in a world where authority is a problem. People don't like deference, they don't like automatically accepting authority, which puts somebody like yourself, an archbishop, in a position which none of your early predecessors, put it that way, could have imagined, I think.
Probably not, though one of the things I often feel as I look around the walls is I don't have it as bad as some of them did, because the 12th century was a century with a great deal of deference, and so was the 17th century. It didn't stop two archbishops getting assassinated. The fact that I'm not getting assassinated is probably an index of a number of things, but among others, that not everyone takes the church with quite the seriousness they did in the 12th or the 17th century. I'm not wholly sorry.
But it is difficult. It does pose a new problem for any organised religious body of ideas, that we now live in a society where anti-authoritarianism, an anti-authority instinct, is quite heavily ingrained. We don't defer to politicians or indeed anybody much.
And I think the good side of that is we don't allow authority to go unchallenged. That's one of the positive legacies of the Enlightenment, I suppose. If someone tells me what to do, I say, so why should I take you seriously? That's okay. The trouble is, I think, that in an environment where no one is particularly willing to learn or to be shaped by an inherited wisdom, you lose out. And again, the balance between saying, well, there's a lot to learn, there's a wisdom which we can absorb from the past.
Well, one of the issues you're raising is about the relationship between authority and truth, because it seems to me that's the power of any church, is to say this is the truth of the major central truth of life, which is that this is what God said. And now we live in a time where truth itself is various. Mm-hmm. Truth is very unlikely to have a singular narrative anymore. And someone like the Archbishop, who I think obviously comes from a very different tradition from older archbishops, is probably able to encompass the idea that religious truth might have various forms. But meanwhile, one of the things, say, about the film that I'm doing now is that people get worried that in Islam, for example, that idea of various truths is not allowed, so you can't play with it anymore. So in fact, it's complex, in fact, whether or not religion exists in a state of absolute moral authority or whether it's in flux.
But I don't think that truth ever had a single narrative, and that's why I think that the beauty of religion or the beauty of religious faith is that it is fluid in some ways. I'm not talking about essential creeds, but the fact that religion religions conspire huge civilizations and translate across cultures and migrate across different societies is precisely because they appeal to something that is beyond just a literal truth or just a single narrative.
Mona's used the word translation there, and I think that's quite important. Right from the start, both Christianity and Islam have been engaged in translating themselves into other cultures, finding new words, finding new structures. Not, as you say, to rewrite the basic narrative, but to say, well, it could be like this, it could be like this, it could mean this as well. And I think there's a difference between saying, well, all truths are just relative, we're all in a sort of swamp of anything goes, and saying there are ways of learning from unexpected sources which say that's true too.
Mm.
We have enough comprehensiveness or enough resource in where we're coming from to take that in as well. I think
but that's very interesting, though, is that notion of relativity not as something, some third way beyond here's an absolute truth, everything is relative. There's a third way, which is, well, there is relative truth, but some truths are more important than others, more equal than others.
Yes, absolutely.
For example, we want to say, most of us, some things about levels of human dignity that are not up for negotiation. If somebody said, well, in certain circumstances, it might be all right to kill newborn children or to torture people to get information, we would all, around the table, I guess, say, no, you can't imagine that. That's not seen as a relative truth about human beings.
Yeah.
So it's not that actually the culture we're in is as relativistic as all that. We do assume there are certain things, certain points where, as the philosopher said, your spade is turned. You hit something hard when you drive in.
But also we live in a globalised world where, I mean, you know, 150 years ago, most of the, not only the religions, but the different parts of the Christian religions had their own territory. You're talking about Ireland earlier on, Archbishop. It, you know, the Roman Catholics had that bit of Ireland. The Anglicans and Protestants had another bit. The Muslims had their territory. And now so we certainly live in a country, if not a world, where people are rubbing up against each other.
That's right. It's one of the things that David's film, I think, brings out wonderfully.
we should come on to the film, actually. We should raise it at this point so that people can understand. Without giving the whole thing away,
yeah.
David, I promise. It's called The Infidel.
Yeah.
And it features, I think we have to say, a Muslim man who's got a pretty devout, parts of his family are relatively devout, and he discovers, oops, he's Jewish.
Yeah, he was born Jewish. He was adopted. Jewish. When his mother dies, he discovers that he was adopted and he was, in fact, of Jewish parentage, yeah.
And one of the remarkable things about the story is that, the way you treat it, is that you don't hold back in jokes. I mean, we don't have many jokes about, we've become quite queasy about religious jokes at the moment, haven't we?
Yeah, well, that is part of the project of the film, is to say, because there's a number of different pressures being brought to bear on you as a writer from that point of view. On the one hand, you know, people say, oh, my God, can you joke about Islam? Will there be a fatwa? Is what a lot of journalists ask. And actually, you know, that was obviously in the back of my mind, I guess, but actually more in the front of my mind was just this kind of 30 years, I said, of, for want of a better word, of political correctness, whereby, you know, post, say, Jim Davidson not being on television all the time anymore, any kind of joke about race and religion was considered off limits. That if you were to joke and find laughter in the subject of ethnicity or race or religion, you must be a racist. And for a long time I thought, well, that's not true. And I've been doing material about being Jewish for a while as a stand-up.
There's some very good Jewish jokes in your film, which will, I suppose, offend some people.
Well, all jokes will offend some people at some point, but I doubt anyone around this table, whether they're an atheist or a very religious person, would think that laughter is anything but a very, very good thing, and therefore God-given or just human-given and a good thing. I did want to break apart any idea that there is a taboo on laughter in those subjects.
Mm. And you're looking particularly in this film at the closeness in many ways of Muslims and Jews. You know, they're in full confrontation in political aspects, but actually very similar in a lot of ways.
Yeah, well, the film is very much about Muslims and Jews. It seemed to me that in the history of sort of ethnic British or whatever comedies, they tend to be about assimilation, actually. If you look at Bend It Like, very good films like Bend It Like Beckmore, East is East, or even Fiddler on the Roof, they tend to be about the way the minority community, normally through one of their daughters getting married to a white person, basically, how they deal with being with the minority community, how they set their place against the table of the... This one, there's only actually one Christian white character in the whole movie, which doesn't mean, by the way, that if you're Christian white, you shouldn't go and see it. It's out there, it's there for everyone in multicultural Britain. But it's about those two communities talking to each other. And I guess I don't know what you think, Miranda, but 30 years ago, I don't think I would have had the idea of this film, apart from not being the right writer for it then, is because I don't think the communities were seen as polarised. I mean, basically, Israel is the key here, and that has made these communities seem polarised, and you need them, as a comedy writer, to be polarised to do a body swap movie.
Mm. I think most people tend to, at least in the public, and that's largely fueled by the media, tend to look at Muslims and Jews have got nothing to say to each other unless they're at loggerheads over Israel and Palestine. And in some ways, what this film touches on is some of the jokes that are inherent within Muslim communities about how Muslims are always trying to follow, you know, even in spatial terms, wherever there's a Jewish community must be a good community, so let's move there. And they move there and the Jewish community moves further away. And the Jewish community that has said to me, you know, Mona, the difference between Jews and Muslims is that when we came to this country, we said, please, may I have something? And you lot came and said, I want, I want, I want. Mm-hmm. And we can laugh at it because we recognise there is an element of that. And in this film, it's interesting that the daughter doesn't want to marry outside the faith, but she actually wants to marry somebody who is an extremist of the son wants to marry somebody who is the daughter of an extremist character. And a lot of people will recognise that as well, that how extremism has become a problem for your average Muslim as well, and how they have to deal with it, not just in the media, but actually with real people sitting on their couches in their living room.
Just if I can jump in and ask Philip Pullman, because the very title of your book, The Good Man, Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ, has already got people going and angry and so on. And I just wondered what you thought about this extremely difficult line between criticising religion, laughing at religion from time to time, or at least laughing, making religious jokes, and, as I say, this sort of queasy, nervous position we seem to be in the culture about offending.
Yes,
groups.
There seems to be a suddenly increased degree of tenderness and sensitivity in people on this subject generally. But the David's film, which I thought was charming, is I must say a word about the cast, because Omid Jalili is a wonderful figure for the main character there. Mm-hmm. And he embodies a sort of warmth and inclusive humanity, this which we can all relate to, whatever tradition we come from.
He's been described as a sort of Muslim Homer Simpson.
Well, the character. Omid himself. Although he looks a bit like Homer Simpson.
Yeah, he's got this great, big, sort of fleshy presence.
But I think Omid is great and a great actor, and also physically could be Muslim and Jewish. One of the key things about Omid for me is he is a very vulnerable, lovable character.
Yes.
And if you're dealing with an issue like this...
He does have a vulnerability as well as he has a real warmth. There are a real range of emotions he can project, which is a wonderful thing in the film. But I will say something about the ending. I won't reveal the ending of the film, but it's sometimes very convenient for a storyteller to find a feat of clay in a bad character.
Yes, yes, yes. No, well, I don't want to give it away either.
No.
There is a revelation, but there are two. This film is not about fundamentalists, actually. It's been described by some people as a film about fundamentalists. It's really actually about ordinary people who's thrown into a particular comic thing to do with religion, but at the either side of them, there are fundamentalists, a Jewish fundamentalist and there's a Muslim fundamentalist. And, you know, the point is neither of them are quite what they seem.
Yeah.
And for me, that's because... I guess, if you're going to make a point about it, and I'm not very interested in point making, the enemies of the people living their lives in an ordinary way and getting on are fundamentalists, and therefore you shouldn't believe them.
But I think, I don't think we should underestimate the significance of the fundamentalism there, and not to look at fundamentalism as purely in these kind of political terms, because obviously people do have to deal with, in these religious communities, with people who have very extreme views, and marriage is a test for that, and this comes out in that film.
Yeah.
And so that's why it becomes very much a real and live issue.
And it's a real test, isn't it, for... The interfaith dialogues that Archbishop, I know you've been very involved in, and Mona Siddiqui as well, at the top of the tree, as it were, there are lots of erudite and useful conversations about everyone being children of the book or whatever it might be, and yet down at street level, in the suburbs of Birmingham and London and all the rest of it, it's become terribly tribal, and any sense that the religious communities have been able to mingle easily seems to be an optimistic fantasy.
Not too much of a fantasy, I hope, because there are quite a few good stories that we could point to, and Mona knows them as well as I do, of mosques and parish churches combining to do local youth work or something like that.
Right.
It can be done, and it can be done exactly at the level that David's film spells out, of people who who are not living in a hermetically sealed social world. There are such worlds around the place, Christian, Jewish and Muslim. Mm. But this is about people who, in fact, are not sealed off. They have a strong corporate identity, but they have to cope with the UK as it is.
Yeah.
And they have to cope, therefore, with each other as they are. And I think that is something that public rhetoric about interfaith tension often loses sight of, that at street level it's very often a great deal better than anybody would imagine.
Well,
one thing,
I mean, it's a buddy movie between a Muslim and a Jew, the Jewish character played by Richard Schiff is from The West Wing, and one of the things that happens early on, which I think is quite unusual in this film, is both those characters, who are the main characters who you're meant to sympathise with, are somewhat racist or have racist inbuilt attitudes towards the other community. Mm. And you know, when they get to know each other through comedy and through
that
sort of breaks
speak.
Down.
That's what I liked about the film. I mean, people do speak in that, to put it gently, robust way.
Well, they do, but I think, A, that's real, and B, the time has gone where, you know, to have a nice character you can buy into, they have to be kind of good in every respect. The truth is that a lot of Muslims never meet any Jews, a lot of Jews never meet any Muslims, and when you've got a lot of stuff in the press about how these two communities hate each other, then that will lead to prejudice.
Meanwhile, there's the rest of the world where everybody gets on with making money and their careers with almost no reference at all to religious faith values or any of these institutions. And I raise that because, Mona Siddiqui, you're on the World Economic Forum Council on Faith, and one of the jobs that you've got, poor you, is going into the world of business and finance and all the rest of it and trying to persuade that world that they have to take religious structures and beliefs and value systems much more seriously than they do at the moment. Is there any chance of anybody listening to you?
Well, let me just clarify that first of all. It's not my job. I suppose it's important to put some context to this. Most people think of the World Economic Forum as an annual meeting in Davos where the world's mega-rich come and all they're concerned about is how to make more profit. But actually, a lot of work goes on behind the scenes throughout the year with WEF, where people, smaller groups, smaller organisations meet to talk with big businesses about new trajectories, how they're doing, what is the impact of business and finance on socioeconomics in different parts of the world, how are they making society better. And 2 years ago, the WEF decided that they would have 60 or 70 councils touching all parts of society, and faith was one of them. And interestingly enough, separate from values, so religious faith was separate from values, to talk about how does religious faith and the vocabulary of religious faith, could it have any impact on big businesses and the context in which we're in, and the fact that there's a moral vacuum at the moment in the way people think about money and profit at the expense of everything else. So I think we realised that it was a huge task that we were looking at, and in some respects you often think, well, who's interested? Big businesses are only ever interested in making more money. But actually, funnily enough, it is interesting to see that over the 2 years, a lot of people from the big businesses, people who are actually making a lot of money themselves, have come into the faith cluster and said, we don't have an ethical framework, and we want one.
That's interesting, because the people I've come across talking to, you know, bankers and hedge fund managers and so on, in the wake of the crisis, you find there's an awful lot of people in the world of business and finance who have religious beliefs or faiths, but many more. But they keep it for after work,
yes,
or after they've retired. They're going to make their shed load of money, then they'll go off and do something good. But they don't want that. They don't want their religious views or any ethical views to impinge upon the day job of making the shed load.
And this is a movement away from mere philanthropy once you've made your bucket loads. Mm. This is actually about how you transform society while you engage in your business.
Archbishop,
I think you're quite right about the sort of firewalls that exist within that world, so that religious questions don't get raised, but I guess that in the last 18 months, enough people have looked into the abyss and thought, well, the way we do things is actually deeply vulnerable. It's not guaranteed to last. It's not guaranteed to go on producing automatic levels of profit forever, without question. So at some stage, you have to address the question, what is a good way of going about things? What is a moral way of doing business? What is wealth for? Why do we talk about growth in the way we do, in the frankly toxic way we often do, in ways that wreck lives and environments? And these, as Mona says, these are questions that are coming up in the sort of vacuum. And what I've found very interesting in the last year or so is just how many groups want to talk about this. Now, Philip and I have both been involved with the citizen ethics thing that The Guardian have been concerned with in the last few months, and I think that's one index of the attempt to get some kind of discourse about the good life, if you like, right back onto the table.
There's plenty of talk about the good life and plenty of people willing to engage in dialogue and so on, but it seems to me a legal problem. There are laws that compel boards of companies to put profit first and make money for their shareholders above all other considerations. That's the problem. And if you change that sort of law and make it a legal requirement also to be ethical and to do good things and so on, that's one of the big ways of solving the problem, because at the moment boards are constrained. No matter how much they want to do good, they're legally not allowed to do good because they've got to make profits.
But you need the profits and you need the risk takers in any society too, and quite a lot of them I think would say, actually, it's much better that I'm allowed to be a buccaneering so-and-so and break all sorts of ethical rules, if not the actual law, make my shed load of money and then spend it directly as a benefactor, not going through the rather soggy and incompetent organisations of the state, in other words, the money would go to.
And that's when you have to ask the question, and how much damage is done en route to, it's an obvious metaphor here, to the currency of business, exchange and commerce, how much do you actually corrupt the environment you're in?
Well, I'm very interested, some of the words that are being used around the table about sustainable and long-term, and Mona was talking about the dangers of these institutions collapsing very quickly. Just in a final part of the discussion, I'm quite interested in where the sort of ethical basis for non-religious, atheist people, where that starts to meet what religious people are talking about.
I think that a lot of the source of the problem that some religious people have in dealing with atheism is that they think that for some reason all ethics come from religion and all moral teaching has to have a religious basis. I don't believe that. I think that we learn a moral standards not only from... Well, we do learn them from religion, but we also learn them from literature, from fairy tales, from myths, from common experience, from the experience of our elders and parents and so on, and our own experiences we go through life. So moral understanding seems to me has a much wider range of sources than just religion.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I'd be the first person here to say that people of religion don't have any monopoly over values and ethics. But it is still interesting to know that if over 80% of people in the world belong to a faith, and we find that hard to believe in the West, that they are still surviving within a context and tapping into resources where notions of ethics and justice and values and being linked to something that is beyond this life does have an impact. It's not to say that religion has a monopoly over values, but religion and religious vocabulary does have a context which many people can tap into.
I think one of the things that you're raising is, you know, in a society that certainly in the West may be moving towards being more atheist, where would values come from? In a way, for me, as an atheist, and I am an atheist, I don't kind of see that as the point in a way. I kind of think, for me, as an atheist, the truth is that God doesn't exist. That is my belief. And as such, the value is truth. And then where morality comes from out of that, I don't really know. But I have to start with what I believe is the truth.
Well, so there's an ethical imperative to the truth if there isn't an ethical imperative anywhere else.
That's what I'm saying.
And yet it seems to me, actually, one of the sources of ethical truth may well be science itself. So, for instance, something we've talked about in this programme before is the drive to be kinder to animals, itself driven by a growing understanding of animals' brains and consciousness, given to us by science, then produces a new ethical imperative that we didn't perhaps feel before.
I don't think that comes from science. I think what science does is to extend the range of a moral capacity or moral sensibility that's there. If science shows me that animals suffer in a way that's rather like the way humans suffer, then it's not that science has told me, so you must be compassionate to animals. It says the compassion you already extend to human beings, you now need to push a bit further. And the question then goes a stage further.
So it gives extra range to an ethical understanding that was there already.
I'm sure that's right. If you have a dog, you know it feels things. You know it senses pain. You know it senses unhappiness and fear and joy and so on. You don't need science to tell you that. But science, as the Archbishop said, does extend our understanding of how this happens through the physiology of the nerves and so on. But the feeling is there already.
And for me, then, the question is, where does that feeling have its ground? And while it's blindingly obvious to me that not everybody with serious ethical commitments has a religious commitment. I want to know where the unconditionality of that commitment derives. It may just be, and I think this is probably what you'd say, it's just there, you know, you take it as it comes.
In your mind it would have a divine source at base.
Yes, that the universe is the way it is, because it comes from God.
But it may just be the case, I have no idea, that there might be a Darwinian need, or there might be another origin for empathy. That's essentially what Philip and everyone is talking about, even with animals. We have an empathy, we know how other people might feel, we know how other beings might feel, and therefore we don't want them to feel bad if we're not bad people.
Sure. Now, if you knew that empathy was a purely Darwinian thing, that it was therefore a survival strategy by another name, would you feel it in the same way?
I might do. I don't think I, as an atheist, I wouldn't need to know that it came from God to feel it.
No, but and if you were to say, there are determining reasons why I feel empathy, I rather suspect that your empathy would feel different then.
You could have an override. An empathy override would come
well,
in.
You could say, I'm not going to do what my genes are telling me. I'm going
That's like listening to a sentence which is of the form, X is only Y.
Yes.
Something is only this, or merely this, or no more than this, or nothing but this, and so on. And I always reject that sort of sentence, because X is always this plus something else. There are always other things that feed into it.
Mm-hmm. Which is why science, I think, doesn't in itself produce ethical insight.
No, it just adds to what we have. I agree with you there.
Well, I'm delighted that we end on a note of absolute consensus between the Archbishop of Canterbury and Philip Pullman. What a good place to conclude. Thank you to all my guests, Dr. Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, of course, and Professor Mona Siddiqui. Philip Pullman's The Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ is out now, and David Baddiel's film The Infidel comes out on the 9th of April. Next week we're back in the studio with the playwright David Hare, meditating on 40 years of work at the National Theatre, the performance artist Laurie Anderson talking about her new piece Delusions, and the journalist Alex Bellos, who's going to be debunking the myth that maths is just for geeks. But for now, from Lambeth Palace, thank you and goodbye.